I think this is one of the things that really struck me from this interview, is she really learns a lot about herself, that actually she isn't as tough as she thought she was, and she learns that because she was assigned to go back to her country, back to her region, back to her community, which she had known as a safe place, as a place that she was a student and she could freely move around and friends and freedom of movement. And then all of a sudden she arrives to a place that is completely shut down, where there are checkpoints all over the place, where people are, you know, darting from one place to the other, terrified that a suicide bomb is going to blow them up. I mean, she was just completely shocked at what had happened. Boko Haram had taken over her world, and that affected her deeply.
I mean, I've worked in worse situations, for example, in Sri Lanka and in Somalia. But maybe this time around, because I am part of that community, it was really so difficult for me to... And we've been trained as humanitarians to try and control your emotions so that you could be able to think clearly and be able to give support. But in this situation, I actually began to doubt myself.
Fatima Muhammad has worked in 10 countries, including Somalia and Sierra Leone. She grew up in a region of Nigeria, which was later taken over by Islamist militants known as Boko Haram. I'm Melissa Fleming, the spokesperson for UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency. And for this series, I want to know what makes someone go to the front line of a conflict to try to save lives. I'm asking my colleagues to do something they very rarely do, to bare their souls, and to tell me what keeps them awake at night. Fatima, welcome to the studio. Thanks so much for participating in this interview and this podcast. It's a pleasure to speak to you.
Thank you very much for having me, Melissa.
Tell me about where you come from.
I'm Nigerian, and I'm from an ethnic group called Hausa. They actually dominate the northern part of Nigeria, but the ethnic group also cuts across Niger, Chad, and also Cameroon. I come from a very traditional and very conservative Hausa family, but very educated.
So they insisted that school was very important for you. And how many siblings do you have?
Surprisingly, because being a Muslim, normally in northern Nigeria, there's a practice of four wives. And my father only is married to my mother. We're six. In number, three girls, three boys. While I was growing up, one of the first things that I learned from my father was, don't think of marriage. Education comes first.
Was that unusual?
Very unusual. Very, very unusual. And that's the way it went. We were not allowed to think of marriage, my sisters and I, until after we had completed postgraduate education.
Wow. So it was all the way to postgraduate. And before that, no boyfriend, no marriage.
Well, being a teenager, you can get away with it.
Okay.
But I mean, it's a very conservative, but at the same time, also very liberal. You can see by the way I dress.
Your head is not covered.
No, my head is not covered.
Tell me a little bit about your dad then. He seems like an enlightened man growing up in a conservative part of Nigeria.
He was a civil servant. Now he's retired. He worked with the immigration service for Nigeria. And then surprisingly, he also worked with the Nigerian Refugee Commission. And that's how my interest in terms of refugee came about.
So like father, like daughter.
Absolutely, like father, like...
Nigeria's Boko Haram militants hit the headlines in 2014 when they abducted almost 300 schoolgirls from Chibok. There was international condemnation. For Fatima, this was personal. The epicenter of Boko Haram's insurgency was the town of Maiduguri, where she grew up. The extremists were forced out, but she chose to go back and work with the traumatized people who had fled their homes, internally displaced people known as IDPs.
To be honest with you, when the Boko Haram started, I was in denial because you hear stories. I mean, you read about it in the media. When I go home on vacation, I hear about it. I live in Abuja, so a bit distance from where the actual Boko Haram activities are. So I was in denial because I didn't want to believe that many of the places that I knew were actually now occupied by Boko Haram. So by the time I began to visibly see the internally displaced in Nigeria, I couldn't believe it. And the stories that they tell you is unbelievable. And I still can't believe that that is happening in my country, in communities where I lived before. Because as I said, my father was a civil servant, so he moved around a lot. And three of the regions that he served in were then actually under the Boko Haram insurgency, now liberated. But a few years ago, they were under the Boko Haram.
And you lived there with him, or you visited him there?
I lived there. I did my primary school, and I also did my secondary school in some of these locations. For example, in Maiduguri itself, I did my primary education.
What was your school like?
We had so much fun. That's the first thing I can tell you. The first thing that I remember about Maiduguri was the number of mango trees. And the mango season, it's everywhere. You don't need to buy mangoes. And I remember in the school, we had so many mango trees that we could, when we have breaks, we just go and that's the fun that we had. You rub it on your school uniform and you just eat the mangoes. Ripe, unripe, it's mango season. Everyone just enjoys the mangoes. I also did my university in Maiduguri. It was an open community where you can celebrate Christmas with the Christians, and then when it's time for Eid for the Muslims, you also celebrate. So it was a very free and open community.
And safe.
And safe. And safe.
So what has happened to your community now must be devastating for you to think about.
Going back to Maiduguri in 2017, I think it was 2017 I went back. The first thing that, before I was deployed, I had a very good manager who said, look, I know you are from Nigeria, I know you're from the north, and I know you've even been to Maiduguri. Please let me know if you cannot handle the situation. Thinking that I was a superwoman and the situation would not affect me, I willingly agreed to go on mission to my degree. The first thing is, I've worked in Somalia, I've worked in Sri Lanka when we had the LTT-controlled areas. My father has never questioned any of my UNHCR deployments, but he questioned my deployments to my degree. The first thing I remember when I told him that I was going into my degree, he said, well, I hope that the UN has put in structures to ensure your safety. So the first thing that I said to him is, but why should you ask me that? Because you have never really asked me any question in relation to my deployment. And he said he has been to Maiduguri a couple of times, and he was shocked at the level in which the destruction was made. So he didn't know, and he said it's a place that he knows before the insurgency and during the insurgency. But he said places like Somalia, places like Sri Lanka, he only watches it on television. So he wasn't able to see it in real life. But he said the insurgency in Nigeria is a reality for him. The first day I arrived at the airport, the first thing I realized was completely deserted. No commercial airlines. It was just the UN flight that we arrived with. And this was an airport previously had a lot of local flights. So that was the first shocker for me. The second shocker was the number of police and military checkpoints all over town. Between the airport to the UNHCR guest house, I can count off head about five checkpoints. So you can imagine the impact. I left Maiduguri about 15 years ago, and then a free community where you can move at night. And then I now return to a community that had checkpoints but also had curfew. So you can imagine the initial shock that
so
I...
So it really felt like a very tense security environment. And then you started talking to some of the people who were affected. What were some of the things they told you?
I'm sure you've heard about the Chibok girls, the 300. These were the girls that were abducted in school. Then I had the opportunity in one of the IDP camps to actually interview not a Chibok girl, but a few of the girls actually that had been abducted by the Boko Haram and then released by the Nigerian army. The two girls that we interviewed were under 20. I think one was in a farm, and then they came. The insurgents came in a bus. They started shooting. She said they tried to run. She was in a farm with her father and mother and brother, I think. And they killed all three. They killed the brother, the mother, and the father, and she was left. So what they told her then was if she accepts to go with them, she will not be killed. So she said she will not go with them. She preferred to be killed. I think repeatedly they kept asking her the same thing for her to realize what she was saying. And then finally she agreed to go with them. Normally the Boko Haram insurgents marry them. And she said she was married to one man and she lived with him. And I asked her, how did you communicate? She said there was no communication. He goes out first thing in the morning. She knows if there's going to be an attack, if they're going to attack a village or a location based on what he carries, maybe his gun, ammunition, etc. And that was it.
What kind of state did you find her in? And then how did you feel about that? This is your people.
Not even my people. Maybe some of them my cousins. Because you know you have distant relatives that you don't know about. But because I'm from the Northeast, and you have relatives that have married each other. So anytime I visit a refugee camp, when I was on mission, I always thought that I could have a distant relative that I'm not aware of and that is right here.
What was that like for you?
At the beginning, I was enthusiastic and I was actually quite happy that I will be going back to my community, that maybe I could even be able to contribute to a lot of things. But I think I was hit by the level of destruction, the level of displacement, the emotions that you can tell on people's faces when you when you're in a vehicle passing. You could see that everyone was in a hurry to get to a location because you didn't want to hang around on the streets, because the suicide bombs attacks happen anywhere, at mosques, at checkpoints, in the IDP camp, at the gate, when you're even entering the IDP camp, anything can happen. So it has changed from when I was a university student. Life was free. There was a famous market that we used to go to. It was called Monday Market, where we used to go every Saturday or Sunday to do grocery shopping. This was off limits for the UN staff, based on the number of attacks, in terms of suicide attacks by the Boko Haram. It was shocking for me that I couldn't go out shopping. Anything that I bought to eat, a driver had to take me quickly, buy it. Everything was organized, from the guest house to the office, from the office for a meeting. You have to report where you are. I didn't have time to reconnect with some of the friends that I had that remained in my degree. About 90% of the people that I know moved from my degree, but a few were stubborn and they decided to stay. But I could not reconnect with them based on the fact that I was heavily protected. I left Geneva, a happy person, very enthusiastic, going back to my country to serve my country for once. But then what I met was completely different.
Is there a particular story? You told one story, but is there another story that really sticks out for you, that you can't forget?
I lived on and off campus. And when I was off campus, I lived in a place called Polo Field. We had IDPs now in the Polo Field. So I decided to, one day when we met for protection monitoring, and I told the driver, I used to live in this area. I would want to trace the former house that I stayed in. I could not. And it was so emotional for me. And the reason why I could not trace it was, one, the number of IDP camps that were all over. People were displaced. Secondly, the destruction of houses. After some time, I think after I spent about a month, I actually stopped going to the IDP camps because I could no longer contain the feelings anytime I go to the camp. It was too emotional.
So, can you describe those feelings?
It's a feeling of, I've worked in worse situations in terms of refugee situations and even IDP situations, like, for example, in Sri Lanka and in Somalia. But maybe this time around, because I am part of that community, it was really so difficult for me to. And we've been trained as humanitarians to try and control your emotions so that you could be able to think clearly and be able to give support. But in this situation, I actually began to doubt myself because I had a feeling that if I go to the camp, I might, to some extent, jeopardize UNHCR's relationship with the government because there were so many gaps in the camp. The thing about Nigeria is how the setup was in the camps was the camps were managed by the government and there were a lot of gaps. And I think the humanitarian agencies have tried their best to see how they could be able to improve the assistance provided for IDPs. But it was to some extent beyond what we could do. So I felt if I continue to go to the IDP camps, I might, being a local, I speak the language, I'm Muslim, I understand them, they know I'm from there. I felt that I might jeopardize the diplomatic relationship that we're supposed to maintain. So I stopped going. That's number one. The second thing was I didn't want a situation whereby I would begin to, how do you say it? I didn't want to become too involved. Too involved in the sense that, for example, I had money, I had food. I didn't want to now start assisting through, giving out assistance of which we are not allowed. Because if I help this person, what of the next person? What of the next person? What of the next person? That means I'm not being fair to everyone. So I felt as if I would begin to emotionally be involved in the humanitarian response. And that was one part. But then the other part was also for the Nigerians. It was such a pride to see, they call me their daughter, to see their daughter actually from the north working with such a prestigious humanitarian organization like UNHCR. So often at times when we go for meetings, if it goes good, if the meeting is good, they would say, oh, you know, she's one of us. She's actually, sometimes they claim I'm from Maiduguri, of which I'm not. But then if it goes bad, then they now tend to say that, but Fatima, you should be able to understand it from our point of view. You should go back and tell the UN that you need to do this. So I felt at some point that I became a pawn and I was being used by the government based on the situation. And that was something that I didn't like. Then my relatives, everyone, because of the situation in Nigeria, everyone was calling me, wanting job opportunities. As far as they're concerned, I work with the UN and I should help them. So at some point, I had to change my local number. So when I explained this to my father, he said, you know what? Just tell them you try your best to see what you can do. Because I needed to maintain my relationship with my family members. And when I say my family, not my direct family, but friends and extended family members. As far as they're concerned, you work with the UN, you're high profile, you should be able to
give jobs to everybody.
Give jobs to everybody, and it's not possible.
So tell me, how did you start working for UNHCR? What was your entry point?
My first duty station was Ethiopia, if you ask me my best duty station now, I've worked in about maybe 10 countries, I would still say Ethiopia. Because it holds so much memories for me. One is that's my first UNHCR duty station, but the culture in Ethiopia, it's rich, the people are beautiful, they have beautiful mountains. It's really a country that...
beautiful food.
Beautiful, delicious food. So Ethiopia was my first duty station.
Okay, so you've worked in some tough places. You said you worked in some, 10 countries, but you did work in places like Somalia and in Sierra Leone. How was it working as a woman in those countries?
For Somalia, it wasn't that difficult, based on the fact that I understood the Islamic culture. So I made sure that I dressed right. When we were going for meetings, I always wear the Islamic hijab. And I knew that if you meet a man, you don't handshake, things like that. So in terms of Somalia, I think in terms of the culture, being a woman, I knew how to position myself. And also I knew, because then I was a senior protection officer, doing protection in Somalia, I can tell you, is difficult. Especially when it comes to issues relating to sexual and gender-based violence. So what I did was, because it was really difficult to explain abuse, domestic violence, to Somali men. And that happens a lot, particularly issues relating to FGM, female genital mutilation, the FGM. It was difficult to explain it. So at some point, what I did was I looked at it from an Islamic point of view. And that was how I was able to discuss more with them. And I found that the first thing is, if I tell them I'm Muslim and if I start talking from a religious aspect, doors are opened for me. So Somalia wasn't that difficult in terms of engagement as a woman.
You mentioned that your father was the one who actually influenced you to work for refugees and the displaced, and he encouraged you to work for UNHCR. Did he do the right thing?
If you ask me this 20 years ago when I first joined and I was in, I would say no. I would say no, because often at times I'll call and I'll tell him that I want to go home. Because anytime I go to the refugee camp and I see something that touches on my emotions, I come back and I call and I say, I think it's time for me to go home.
It was too much.
It was too much. And also sometimes when you, because with the Southern Sudanese, there was a lot of, they call it clan conflict. Now I now witness violence in the refugee camp.
What did they say to you?
Oh, my father would not hear of it. He would say, you need to continue to work.
Why do you think so? Because he must have missed you.
They all did. A family of six, but I was the only one living at home because all the rest had left working in Nigeria, but they were not living at home with my parents. So I did everything for them. I paid the bills, I did the errands, market, I did everything while I still worked as a civil servant. But then over the years, I got so attached with humanitarian work, specifically working with refugees.
Why is that?
It's you can actually see when you're in the field, you can see the impact of what you are doing. For example, it could be family reunification. It could be support to a victim of domestic violence. It could be a simple thing like registration, whereby refugees come from the border with nothing, absolutely nothing. You register them, and that's the ticket for them to get food. And they hold on to this, we call it ration card. So you can see the impact of what you're doing. And after Ethiopia, I never looked back. And I always wanted to work in similar situations out in the field, never at headquarters, because I felt that the work is out there in the field. In fact, I couldn't detach myself from working in hardship duty situations. Because at some point, especially in my field, because I started as an associate protection officer, you solve everything for the refugees, issues relating to marriage, birth, everything. So I never wanted to work at headquarters.
Helping them get married and have children. What were you sacrificing for yourself?
The thing about it is you get so carried away that you keep saying next year for yourself, next year for yourself. And next year down the road for me was, I think I worked for UNHCR for 18 years before I got married. And even if you want to, because you're in such a remote location, the distance it creates. And then at some point I told myself that I have to marry a Nigerian. I should marry a Nigerian because I wanted to maintain the cultural ties. And then when I go for rest and recuperation, I wanted home to be home, you know, because I see colleagues that are married to other nationalities. And when it comes to home leave, sometimes they don't know where to go. It's 2 weeks here, 2 weeks there. But the thing about the community that I come from, as I said, it's very conservative, the houses. Many of the men that I met, they give me an ultimatum. You have to come back and live in Nigeria if you want to settle down. And I think I wasn't ready to do that. And my father once told me, he said, your job should not be a condition for marriage. Yes.
An enlightened man.
Yes.
So who was the lucky man? Where did you find him? Somebody who would understand your lifestyle.
Uh-huh. I didn't marry a Nigerian. Yes. My husband is from Sierra Leone.
Okay. Yes. And where did you meet?
We met in Liberia. Mm. Yes, we met in Liberia, and he works with UNHCR.
Ah, okay.
Yes. My husband works with UNHCR. He is a head of field office in Nigeria.
Oh, my.
So it couldn't get better for me.
The title of this podcast is called Awake at Night. And the reason is that, you know, I speak to a lot of colleagues who, like you, take in the stories, the tragedies, countless tragedy stories of refugees and the people who they're caring for. And I always wonder, and I want to ask you that question, what is it that keeps you awake at night?
Well, it depends on the duty station, the location. I can take you back to my degree, where when we go back to the guest house, we don't know whether there will be a Boko Haram attack or not. And I always imagine myself, what if they attack and they discover I'm Nigerian, I'm educated, and I work with the UN? Because I said I would definitely be abducted. So these are the things that actually go through, you know, that's what keeps me awake until sleep takes over. But I can tell you that every morning that I wake up, I thank God that I'm alive. That's one place. And the second place is, before I went on mission to Nigeria, I was also on mission in Somalia. First and foremost, the flight. Because how you even land, it's miraculous. Because you don't know whether, maybe it's my imagination, but you don't know whether Al-Shabaab sniper would target the flight. You know, you don't know. So for me, first arrival was scary. And then when I arrived at the airport, it was filled up with barricades. And the first thing was they took me to the bunker, and that was where I got my security briefing. And the shocking thing about the security briefing was he said on several occasions a rocket had landed in one of the compounds. So I asked him, I said, so there's a possibility if we go to bed at night, a rocket could? He said, absolutely, we should be prepared. And then he said I should always have a bag that had everything, a change of clothes, things that I can, in case we had to now run to the bunker, we should just take that. First night, I can tell you, Melissa, I changed into my nightgown. I went to bed. I don't know how I went to bed, but then after that, I slept always in with a t-shirt, a shorts, and my jeans was where I knew I can grab it, and my sneakers, so that in case something happens, I'll just, if I can, I'll pick it up, but I was always prepared. So I can tell you those were sleepless. I think I slept more during lunch break, peaceful sleep during lunch break, but at night, because you didn't know. I thought I was tough. Honestly, I thought I could endure anything in terms of security. But then the day that I left, I was relieved. I said, thank God, I have come out of this alive. And then I now began to think about my colleagues that work there, that are assigned there. How do they manage? Now that has kept me, so in terms of sleepless night, it's all related to security, personal security, safety, etc. I learned a long time ago never to take the stories that I hear from refugees home, because then it will become too much to handle. So when I'm home, I'm really home. You have to find a way to separate yourself from all those emotions.
What do you do to kind of, shut down? And do you have any hobbies? And do you enjoy?
I read a lot. I watch television a lot. And then I also write poems for each country that I work in. The moment I arrive in a country, I begin to document whatever it is I see.
Yeah, you have some in your head, in a few lines in your head that you could.
I can maybe remember how I framed it. I can give two examples. One is Ethiopia. Once again, as I said, I'm really attached to Ethiopia. I talked about the untapped culture. I talked about the source of the Nile. I talked about the rich culture and beautiful mountains that they have. And I made a few examples of in the local language.
Do you remember any lines?
Perhaps the line that I remember is the one in Sierra Leone, where I mentioned something like, because Sierra Leone, they call it Salon with its rusty rooftops, just like the black diamonds, that something like that. Because, there was a lot of bloodshed in Sierra Leone. So I wanted to give an example with the rusty rooftops and then give an example with the black diamonds. And I think one sentence that I know for sure that I said in Sierra Leone was the country that was never colonized. What I have not been able to write about is Nigeria, my degree. And I don't know if I really can do that. Maybe later on I would try, but at this stage I have not even written anything on my degree.
Fatima, thank you so much for sharing all of these insights and the stories of your life, a fascinating career with UNHCR, and I wish you all the best and a lot of safety as well. As I see, you are determined to continue to work on the front lines of humanitarian response.
Thank you. It's been an amazing journey, and I hope to continue that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Fatima.
Thank you. Sierra Leone. Sierra Leone, where are the so-called riches from the earth's core? I see the much talked about mines, but with no diamonds or gold. Tell me, where have the riches vanished to? I would like to see the blood diamonds that stain the eyes and souls of many. Sierra Leone. Though your pain is as deep as the ocean, yet a miraculous rainbow now hovers gracefully over you. The only memories of the pain that once was remain the rusty rooftops, which look like stained blood. Sierra Leone, the West African queen, which refuses to be crowned and yet still without a king. Sierra Leone, your beauty is rare, untapped, yet quite known. My sweet Salon, as is always fondly called.
Thanks for listening to Awake at Night. Find out more about the series and read more of Fatima's poetry by visiting unhcr.org/awakeatnight. Find us on Facebook at UNHCR and on Twitter we're @refugees and I'm @MelissaRFleming. Please spread the word about the series using #AwakeAtNight. Thanks to Alex Court and the fantastic design and studio teams here at UNHCR, and to my producers, Bethany Bell, and also Laura Sheeter of Chalk and Blade. The original music for this podcast was written and performed by Nadine Shaw and produced by Ben Hillier. Nadine's latest album, Holiday Destination, is inspired by the Syrian refugee crisis, and it's incredible. My guest next week has one of the toughest jobs at UNHCR, leading our mission in Syria. He tells me about the images that come back to him and keep him awake at night.